about is the result of a couple of years' work, 3 years' work. A lot of people have been involved, and here's some of them. Actually, there's a bunch of interns, Ken, Son, and Croc, all interns when they work with us. Tal's now at Google, and the Live Search team. So what this talk is really about is the following problem. It's very nicely defined, which as a consequence has means that a lot of people want to work on it. So tons of people in MSR are working on this and outside of MSR. And here's the problem I'm trying to solve. You're given a query, which is a text, piece of text, and somehow you get a large list of candidate URLs. It's probably generated by looking at words in the query and words in the documents and checking that at least one occurs, that kind of thing. And for each URL, we're going to compute a feature vector, which is just a vector in Rn. And most features that we so compute depend on the query and the document, although some depend only on the document. I mean, some documents might be known to be junk, in which case they have a low value for that junk feature. You're going to feed these feature vectors into your ranker, which maps Rn to R, and then sort the URLs by the return scores and show the results to the users. And it's that simple. Actually, it's not that simple. There's a lot of other sort of bells and whistles. If we happen to know that there's a result is correct, you might show that first. So the context of this talk, first of all, I'm going to talk about information retrieval. When I say IR, I mean information retrieval. And I'm going to argue that often we're learning the wrong thing when we try to learn these things. I'll give a very brief overview of web search, even not quite as brief as I thought I just gave. And then some recent work, RankNet and LambdaRank. RankNet really is a precursor for what I'm going to talk about later. LambdaRank is sort of built on the same ideas. And then I'm going to show that these neural nets are surprisingly robust to label models. The result I found last week. So in fact, I'm going to talk about optimal combiners, which means I have two rankers. How do I combine them optimally? It turns out actually we can use IR metrics against themselves to solve that exact thing. And then a bunch of you probably already know about this. It's an old algorithm. Did we know about this? Simultaneous perturbation, stochastic approximation. Okay. In 1992, I think, James Small wrote a paper. So we tried this. I'll talk about this. It's very interesting. It's not new, though. And then some newer stuff, gradient boosting, and finally DAGs for ranking, directed acyclic graphs. So the whole goal here is to solve the problem I just described. Are we learning the wrong thing? Let me give you an example of people learning the wrong thing. Here is a support machine layout. We're trying to separate circles from the crosses, and we've got a nice fat margin here, and there's a normal to the hoop plane, so this is a pattern recognition problem, which we solved nicely. And this is what we solved to get that solution. And the W is this vector, normal vector. These Cs are slack variables, which are positive. They bound the error rate. So by minimizing the Cs, you're actually minimizing the convex bound on the number of errors. And this is this is the whole thing. The problem here is, maybe it's not a problem, but we're not actually minimizing the number of errors. We're minimizing a convex bound on the number of errors. And this sometimes leads you astray. And I'm going to argue that that's the case here. Okay, I'm not from information retrieval, and when I first got sort of interested, I was surprised by the number of metrics people use, so let me list some of them here. There's the good old precision and recall. So you set a threshold, you look at everything above the threshold, and you count the number you got right. Recall is the number of all possible things you get right in the entire database. And then they have various other metrics. All of these are binary metrics. A document is either relevant or it's not relevant. And they're all very hard to optimize. Michael Berry talked about ROC curves. They also use ROC curves. In fact, the fraction pairwise correct is the area under the ROC curve. So those are binary measures. We want to do a little bit more in that we want to say some documents are very relevant, others are less relevant, and others are less relevant. And we're going to have five levels of relevance. So R stands for rating here. So we're adopting a measure called the normalized discounted cumulative gain, which is a mouthful, but it just means this. It's very simple. So T here is a truncation level. You might show the user 10 results. Maybe we'll truncate at 10. We're going to discount as the rank. So rank, the top result is ranked 1, and then 2, 3, 4. So we're counting down from the top of the list of documents. And so as we go down, the weight we give gets less and less. This is the discount. The D in the NDCG is this thing here. The cumulative means you just sum up the gains from everything in the top T possible. Let's say T equals 10 for this talk. And then we want to rate things that are very relevant much higher than things that are less relevant. So R is 0 through 4. So 4 here gets a big number, and 0 gets 0, actually. And this is called the DCG. And it's in its own right a very useful measure, actually, quite before we normalize it. The NDCG N means normalize, and we just divide by the max. So this now takes the values between 0 and 1. So 1 is ideal. So this is the measure I'm going to be talking about throughout this talk. It's cumulative and multi-level relevance. And that's really why I'm going to use it. So to emphasize, all of these costs have the following in common. They depend only on the labels and the sorted order of the documents. This is scary. Viewed as a function of the scores, so you've got some model that generates a score. If that model generates slightly different scores, but the sorted order does not change, none of these metrics change. And that means that the cost you like to measure, I mean, the costs are either flat in the scores or they're discontinuous, and that's really nasty. It's hard to define gradients to do gradient descent on spaces like this. I'll actually come back and show that you can do gradient descent on spaces like this. So here's a high-level view of what we're trying to do. And I think this is what machine learners in general try and do. They have some interesting but often intractable problem P, and here P stands for problem. We would relax this and rewrite that and make it convex and maybe optimize a bound instead of the thing itself. And then we wind up with a nice convex problem. It's amenable to analysis, it's tractable, maybe after some further approximations. But the problem we wound up with is not the problem we started with. And this is usually a bad sign when you try and optimize things. Some people argue it's not, but I think it is. So instead, what we'd like to do is design algorithms with P stay as close as possible to this P, this problem. You wind up with something that's tractable and is close in the space of measuring distance in terms of the problem. And here is where this talk lands, at the very bottom, RACnet, and later on I'll describe what MART is. So the talk is attempting to go this way. We're trying to get closer and closer to solve directly the problem we care about. And as we do so, we'll find we get better results. But it generates a bunch of new ideas. So here's a mathematical technical term, blazingly. This is really key, actually. I think we often don't pay much attention to how fast things have to be in test phase, but in this particular application, it has to be extraordinarily fast in test phase, and that puts constraints on what we do. So now for a brief, high-level overview of how web search works, and why is it interesting. I probably have to tell you why it's interesting, but let me just say anyway. Internet advertising revenues are about $4 billion, according to the Interactive Advertising Bureau, and it's growing extremely fast. If you look at this graph, it really is going up. Ranking is a key component of lots of different things. If you do ranking well, it helps solve lots of these problems. And last but not least, it's generating interesting new science, at least there might have been interest. So live search, which is the toy that I play with, we have actually a lot more than 5 billion documents now, tens of millions of queries handled a day, thousands of machines, and this is the reason we have to be fast, is that people do not have to wait. Here's a very, very schematic view of how it works. A query comes in one end of the system. There might be things that get done to it. For example, instant answers might try and answer it directly. But in general, usually, it'll get sent off to these mid-level aggregators, and then you'll wind up in a row of machines on which we have the entire index of the web, one of n rows of machines, say 500 machines. And each machine does its own ranking, and then the aggregators will aggregate those ranking results and show them to the user. In the back end, these machines talk to index builders and static rankers, which just means static rank is a query-independent value. It's like PageRank. We might use it to say decide what to crawl next or just give an independent feature to the ranker, and then we crawl the web. And that's roughly how it works. Okay, so now let's start talking about how we actually try and solve this problem. It's actually resulted in a flurry of work recently. There were four papers from MSR Beijing in this year alone. I'm not going to go through all these. I just want to show you that people are very interested in trying to apply machine learning. I think the reason is that it's such a nice encapsulated problem. You give a bunch of training data, you've got the labels, you've got a nice metric to try and optimize, go away and do it. And you don't need the whole search engine to solve this, you just need that data. These are slightly older things. It's been going on for quite a while. People trying to learn how to rank. Okay, so again, I think I said this, but let me just reiterate. We're given a set of text queries, which I'll call Q. Each query has a large set of return documents, so index query index I, document index j. And we're going to use the query, the document, the URL, anchor text, which means the text in the web that just points at that query, which is very indicative of what might be on that page, and other things to derive sets of several hundred features, such as, for example, x might be in here. here too. Then we're going to rank, and all of the systems I'll talk about map this feature vector to a single score. So let's start with RankNet, because the reason I want to describe RankNet is that it was used in Live Search for a while, and it's the basis upon which we've done a lot of other research. First thing is, you could imagine just trying to learn the values. You don't have to do that. It's better to do a more relaxed, more direct thing if you can. We just need to map the values to the reals so that when we sort them, we get the sorted order we need. That's a less constrained problem because there's an overall offset here that we don't care about, right? The actual score we don't care about as long as it gives the right sort of order. And that means that different queries can have different offsets, and that gives the system more freedom than it would otherwise have. So we're going to train on pairs. We don't have to, I'll describe other systems later, but to start with, we'll do this. And I'll just assume the convention that the first point will be ranked higher than the second. In test phase, it's far too slow to test on pairs, because in test phase, you're showing things to a user that's in real time. So we'll evaluate on single feature vectors and do this ordering. I'm going to use the cross-entropy cost just to get a probabilistic model. I'll describe it later. And we'll use gradient descent throughout most of this talk, not all of it. So as I mentioned, we have five laws of relevance. They're actually called bad through perfect. And that with a few hundred features and one output. I'm going to sort. And here's the key thing. And this really is why RankNet worked at all, I think. None of the stuff I've talked about so far actually knows about NDCG. But when you train a net, you do an epoch and then another epoch. And an epoch means go through the training data once and adjust the weights a little bit, stochastic gradient descent. If after each epoch we compute the NDCG, which we do care about, on a set-aside set, and keep the net that gives the best NDCG, that works really well. It's just a hack, but it works really, really well. So what is this cost function I mentioned? I'll come back to this later. Ranking labels tend to be very noisy. It's actually really hard to label web data, because you don't know what the intent of the user was often. And you know, there might be several different possible intents. So it's hard to do that. But we're going to specify, we're going to assume we have that. So A triangle B means A is to be ranked higher than B. So this just means to be ranked higher than. The training data can be completely inconsistent. You could have A ranked higher than B, B ranked higher than C, C ranked higher than A. You never know. But the test results are by definition consistent because they're just a sorted order of a function. So now we're going to model the posteriors as given that I want to rank xi and xj. The probability that xi is to be ranked higher than xj is just p. That's what I'm going to model. The target posteriors are going to have a bar over them. And these are actually, we use 0, 1, usually. This is the output of the model. And I'm going to define the difference in the outputs for two items. Now remember that xi is to be ranked higher than xj. So we'd like this to be positive, so that this is higher than this. And when it sorts, that gets placed higher than that. The cross-entropy cost is a pairwise cross-entropy cost. And it's just this, if you write it out. I mean, that's what cross-entropy is. These are the targets. These are the model outputs. Neural nets just give unscaled things as outputs. So we're going to map them to probabilities using a softmax-like logistic regression map here. And if you plug that into here, this is what you get for the cost. What does this cost look like? It's actually very reasonable. Suppose I have, I know with probability 1 that the first guy is going to rank higher than the second, then the cost goes down if they're in the right order, but it increases linearly, which is very nice, because linear far away is more robust than quadratic, in the difference in the output scores of the system on those two items. If, on the other hand, I'm completely unsure about which is to be ranked higher, I get this curve, which tends to gently push them together to have the same score. So it's well behaved, it's a nice cost. However, it's not quite as simple as it sounds. If I have this model, then if I'm going to say that there's a target probability for some pair ij, I better have some output to my model mapped to that target probability, or else I'll never be able to learn, right? And this means that there are consistency requirements on any pair. If I have a pair ij and another pair jk, pik, the probability that I is going higher than k is not arbitrary, it's fixed by this. This is not usually a problem. It arises from the fact that we're using pairs, putting constraints on pairs. So let's just check that does make sense. Imagine that these p's are all the same. So I'm going to say probably they're all equal to p. Probably the bias to be ranked higher than j is equal to p. J is higher than k is equal to p. What you get, and you get something that makes a lot of sense. If they're equally, uncertainty propagates. So if they're both probabilities are half, I don't know which is higher, I don't know which is higher, then the probability that a is greater than c is also, I don't know which is higher. And as you build up, it goes in the right direction. So if this p is less than a half, you stack on top, then the combined probability from I to k, where k is further down the list, gets smaller and smaller. And similarly, if p is greater than a half, it gets bigger and bigger. It's just a sanity check that this behaves as we'd expect. In fact, the p's can be completely specified by just saying what they are for every adjacent pair in a given sort of the list. And this proposition is just in words what I just drew, so I won't go through it. This is actually an application of what's called the Bradley-Terry model. It's quite old. But basically, it's given that an event A or B occurred, what's the probability of A is modeled like this, where these are just parameters to be learned. And in our case, it's something like this. So it's an old model, but what's new is it's pairwise, based on pairs. Now, you might think that training on pairs is prohibitive, but it really isn't, for two reasons. The first is that you only look at pairs for a given query. You don't look at pairs between queries. And the second is that you only look at pairs that have different labels, usually. And most things have the same level. So the number of pairs is nothing like this spread, which is a good thing. Still a lot of pairs, but we can train on that. We, as I mentioned, have data from four what are called streams, the anchor text, the URL, document, the title, and the body. And the number of features fluctuates throughout the talk, but it's in the several hundreds usually. These are all results. I'm going to get into newer things. So RagNet is simple to train. I actually thought I had some results on it. Anyway, it does well. It does well compared to what it was compared against at the time. It's simple to train, it's fast in test phase, gives good results. And for things where you actually have pair-based probabilities, like click rates, you might say a person clicks A higher than B, and after you've corrected for positional bias, you might have a measure like this. It's actually really well suited to that problem, so it's good for that. But the cost function is not NDCG. So it's a very indirect way to optimize it. So the question is, can we do better? And the answer is yes. And let me just say why pairwise error is a problem. Remember I drew this cost? This is the cost as a function of the output scores of the model for the two separate items where O1 is to be, where the first is to be ranked higher than the second. So you want O1 minus O2 to be positive, so the cost goes down. So I'm very roughly going to model that as this. Well, this counts the number of pairwise errors. It's a very, very rough approximation to the number. It's a convex approximation to the number of pairwise errors. Why is that a bad thing? Well, imagine we have the following situation where I've ranked something in the middle of learning this complicated model, and I have something I have two levels of relevance. The blue guys are relevant, the black are not. So this guy's perfect, he's right at the top, marvelous. But this guy's highly relevant and is way down at the bottom, so that's bad. So what we're going to do is do the RankNet thing, and then this may get dropped down a little bit because it doesn't have many pairwise errors pushing it in any particular direction. This can go up thousands, so I could have reduced the number of pairwise errors by many, right? Every black, blue pair is a pairwise error, so the number of slots I move up is the number of errors that I remove. But I've killed myself, because the guy at top now is no longer relevant. So I've improved the pairwise errors, but I've made everything worse. The gradients look like this. What I want them to do is look like that. And the question was, how do we build a model where the gradients are what I care about for NDCG? And so what you really want is to be able to, if you imagine you just have a general information retrieval metric, you'd like to write down rules where in a given situation, I want this guy to go up with this much push and this guy to go up with this much push. So think of these as forces, as physical models. I'm with Vladimir on this, I like physical models. So we'd like, these are actually the gradients, don't forget, of the cost with respect to the score of the model. So we just want to specify this. Forget about the cost, I just want to specify the gradients. And then use these derivatives to train a model. So that is the program with Lambda. We're going to forget about the cost. The sorting messes everything up. So you take the URLs, you sort them, and then you attach an arrow based on where they are with respect to the other URLs with different labels. And then you use those arrows as gradients and train a neural net on that. That roughly is the idea of Lambda Rank. Here's a very simple example. Two documents, D1 and D2. The first is relevant, the second is not. Imagine some cost such that these little arrows, that's the arrow for the blue guy, that's the arrow for the black guy, number one, number two, are the derivatives of some cost. Then I would like, as a function of the output scores of the model, these arrows to have these properties that when the things are in the wrong order, this gets pushed up and that gets pushed down. When they're right on top of each other, output scores are the same. There's still a push because you're trying to separate them. When they're far enough away and in the right order, the cost goes to zero. So I'd like this to be my cost. Is there a cost like that? Yes, it's very simple. It looks like this. And in fact, it's convex. You can actually write down a cost that has these derivatives. But that does raise an interesting question, which is, when does there exist such a cost? Okay, first of all, lambda rank is general. I mean, you can write down any arrows you like, but the problem is deciding what they should be. So how to choose the lambdas is the black box part of lambda rank. But there's an interesting question. When will there exist a cost for which your lambdas are the derivatives of that cost? And in fact, when will that cost be convex? So it's easy to write down what you'd like to have happen in a situation where you're given the sorted order of your wells. But then maybe you're doing something crazy because there's no cost. So this is just a one-side reminder of multilinear algebra. It's actually, okay, so an N-form on a manifold, it's a total anti-symmetric tensor, written the dual of the tangent space of manifold. There are these things called one forms and two forms and N-forms that live on these manifolds. You can apply a differential operator to an N-form to get an N plus one form. A closed form is one for which its derivative vanishes, an exact form for which it's one for which it is a derivative, and every exact form is closed. Don't worry about this at all. I just want to look at a simple interpretation, but I need to describe the lemma. So the lemma is Poincaré's lemma. It says that if a set is an Rn and it's an open set that's star-shaped, meaning you can point at the laser pointer from the origin and stay inside the set until you get the boundary, then any closed form defined on this set is exact. So on such a set, a form is closed if and if it's exact. So we're going to take our lambdas and define a one form this way. Then, and we're asking, when does there exist a cost for which the lambdas are derivative? Well, Poincaré's lemma says this is the case. D lambda must be zero, which is just this condition here. The Jacobian of the lambdas must be symmetric. In fact, the Jacobian is the square matrix of psi, the number of documents. There's a family of Jacobians, one for each label set. If it's symmetric, you're all set. The cost exists. Otherwise, not. If in addition it's positive semidefinite, the cost function is convex, because then the Hessian is positive semidefinite. So that's kind of a nice way to look at it. It's a bit like a kernel for those machine learners out there, but it depends on all the data, not just pairs. But it gives us confidence that we can actually use these things. There really is a physical analogy underlying this. You can think of the rank documents as point masses, and these lambdas as forces pushing up and down, given a sorted order. And then if there does exist a one form such that lambda is d of c, those forces are conservative. They derive from the potential. So for example, if you choose the lambdas to be linear in the sort scores, like the example I gave you, that's equivalent to having a spring model pulling things up and down physically at the point masses. OK, now I just want to point out that lambda rank actually had another benefit, which we noticed that if you optimize, the neural net training I've done so far is stochastic. You show a pattern, you change the weights. Show a pattern, change the weights a little tiny bit each time. That's stochastic gradient descent. But here what we do is we're going to update after each query. So we're going to take a query, compute all the lambdas, update for all the lambdas, and then do one giant update for that query. And it turns out if you do this, that's not sufficient, because don't forget that we're doing pairs, so the updates depend on pairs of things. But you can, in fact, factorize the gradient. So that it becomes very efficient to train this graph. In fact, it's close to On, as opposed to On squared. So this is the log of the number of documents you're training on for a given query, and that's the log of seconds per epoch on our machine. Our lambda rank training is this little trick of doing this batch per query and then factoring the gradients. Gives you an almost linear dependence that it's still basically quadratic, but the quadratic part is incredibly simple. It's just a sum over sigmoid-like things. So it doesn't dominate. If you went out further, it would begin to become quadratic, but we don't need to go out further because we don't train on that much data. So what lambda function gave us the best results? Here it is, and it's very intuitive. This is actually what you get. It's the derivative of this is the gradient of the rank net cost. Remember, it's that nice smooth curve, linear in one direction and goes to zero in the other direction. So that's the cost we know and love that gave us good results before. But now we're going to weight it for each pair by the NDCG gain you get. That's what the N is here, just a normalization factor. This is the gain you get for swapping the two documents. So I have my query, I have my two documents. This is a highly relevant, this is bad, this is perfect. I want to swap them. So this guy is going to get narrowed down, this guy's going to get narrowed up, equal and opposite forces. And the size of the force is proportional to the gain I'd get if I did actually swap them. It's a heuristic, but it works really well. In fact, I'll come back later to show you, we think this is actually optimal in some sense. Okay, so what do? We compute this for every pair. And then to get the gradient on a given point, we sum for all the guys that have label less than the one I have, and subtract the same thing for all the guys that have label higher than the one I have, and my forces add up, they're just forces adding up on each URL. Then I take those forces and I do backplot, and I adjust the weights and my neural nets, and off I go. And it really works. So here's NDCG on 10,000 training queries, of order 50 documents per query, 5,000 validation, 10,000 tests, and it beats Lambda rank consistently. This is the truncation level I mentioned. So this is the top result, top two results, top three results. These are all cumulative results. And this is the NDCG. So that
Sorry, Chris, is the horizontal axis the T that you use during training or the T that you use during test?
The T that we use during training is actually, we don't use a T during training.
You just take all the relevant
guys. We take all the relevant guys. Because the trouble is taking T during training, and we've got some good stuff down here that you don't see at all. So we don't. So that's a good question. So we don't. We only take T during tests, but it still helps them. I think if you have enough data, you can do that. But we don't. So here's a very weird thing, surprising to me. I did a test. We were wondering how cleaning the labels might help us do better. So how robust is this labelness? This is a purely empirical result. It's, as I said, it's very, very hard. If you're a user and you see somebody else's query and the results, you may have no idea what it means. GSA, is that Girl Scouts of America or General Services Administration? I don't know. So you have to sort of get what these intent was. If there were several intents, how do we label it? So it's very hard to label these things correctly. But we can measure the noise in the labels by measuring overlapping judgments. So you send the same things to two different judges, and you make a confusion matrix of how many where they agreed and where they disagreed. In fact, this is the confusion matrix we can make. So you take a whole bunch of data, send it to pairs or even more judges, generate this matrix. So here's how we're going to measure how robust this is to noise in the labels. We're going to take this confusion matrix, and we're going to take artificial data, 300 features, which is typical, 30 documents per query, also fairly typical, a fair amount of data, in the millions of documents altogether. And then this artificial data is essentially a random cubic polynomial that I've mapped to a number by taking a dot product with it's a random cubic polynomial of the features and so on. But because I've got this sort of hidden black box that generates this data, I can generate completely clean labels. Because I just take the output, and everything on the top, you know, the top quartile I call perfect, then the next I call good, and so forth. So I can generate absolutely clean, zero noise labels just by having a function that I'm trying to model. So what's going to happen here is I have a function. The neural net doesn't know about this function. It has to learn it just from the data. I can use this function to generate totally clean labels and totally clean data. The data's just random. But the way the labels are generated is this cubic polynomial of random features. So then we're going to train Lambda rank. Now what we're going to do is apply this confusion matrix that was measured on real data and say, this guy called this a perfect, but with probability 1/3, another guy called it a bad, which happens, actually. And then we're going to retrain. So now we're pretending we're in the real world, but the labels are really noisy. But we're going to test on the clean data to figure out how much it hurt us. So when I saw these results, I was kind of amazed. But this is what we got. So here is training on clean, testing and validating on clean. There's so much data here that the train, validation, and test results are almost all identical. They're all on 0.70 something. As I say here, this is the NDCG at 10. So this is looking at the top 10 results. It's very close to the training because there's so much data. This is a two-layer Lambda rank net, 10 hidden nodes. And then the NDCG at 3, NDCG at 1. Now, if I apply once this confusion matrix, the training goes through the floor. It's much, much harder to learn. It drops from 0.705 all the way down to 0.5. This is a huge drop as we measure things in NDCG. And the test, it looks the same on the noisy data. But the test on the clean data is almost unchanged. It was able to learn the correct functional dependence, despite the fact that we tried to hurt it, you know, quite nastily by applying this very nasty confusion matrix. apply the conversion matrix twice. Again, the training drops drastically. Another, I mean, the point here is something we spend a lot of effort trying to get. This is a 17 point or something drop. But again, the clean data is doing really well in the test set. So it's still learning this underlying dependency. I think that the bottom line message here is, even though the labels are noisy, if you have enough data and a strongly enough regularized model, you can still learn it very nicely, as this shows. So it was somewhat unexpected. I thought this would drop more than it did. It's a very strongly regularized model. But that does, there's two sides to this story. The first is that we've learned that the thing we're using is very robust to label noise. That may be because there's a lot of label noise, and the thing that worked best had to be robust to label noise. But also, if we can get cleaner data, maybe more flexible models would do much better. And in fact, we have evidence that this is true too. If you take a system that I'm going to describe in a minute on this same data, it'll give a 10-point gain to this. Because it's a much more flexible model, it's less well-regularized, it's less smooth in the set of functions it can model. But it can learn the dependencies in more detail. So it's an interesting result.
Oh, question.
Yes?
Can you use one of the models to throw out the bad data? And then train a more flexible model on
good. We've tried that. So far, most of our efforts on label cleaning like that, in fact, we've done that based on clicks. You might use clicks and you might remove the bias and then train, say, a ranker just to say, I think that it should be this, and then throw out the obviously egregious kind. I've tried lots of experiments like that. None of them worked. In fact, there was another one where I just did 10-fold cross-validation, look at the guys in the test set that are most sensitive, the NDCG is most sensitive to the value of the label these guys had. Just throw those out and retrain. We couldn't make any headway. So that's actually what led to this experiment. And this experiment is telling us why we couldn't make any headway. It's that it's learning the dependency despite the noise. So removing the noise isn't hurting much. It isn't helping much. It would help if we had more flexible models, I think. In fact, we know, because we have more flexible models and it does help. So to answer your question a bit more, if we had, for other models, yes, it would help. For this one, no, we don't think so. Okay, so it's simple in general, can handle any cost, but how do we choose these lambdas? It leverages existing neural net methods, it gives a significant speed up in ranknet, it gives better accuracy in ranknet. Seems to be pretty robust noise, but it's still not directly optimizing NDCG. Can we do better? So here, yes?
So the lambda is like a gradient that you compute, right?
That's
so
right.
Do you know what is the cost function associated
with
lambda?
It's actually pretty straightforward, because the lambda is the product of the ranknet gradient times your overall scaling factor. So for a given sorted order of the URLs, we know what the ranknet cost is, and that's what the cost is for lambda. That cost times this factor. But as soon as two documents change, the whole thing changes, right? So it changes smoothly, actually. But the cost does change smoothly. There's not an up arrow and down arrow, they will gradually change in their size, but the directions won't change. So there's no sudden discontinuity to the cost. So for a given sort of order, we can write down the cost. Okay? Just a mess to do it in general. So these IR metrics are tough, because we can't directly optimize. We've tried twice, and not so far. So here's a trick. These things are finite discontinuous, remember? As a function of the scores, the metric that we care about, NDCG or these other things, only depends on the scores when they cause a change in the order of the sorted documents. Now suppose you have two rankers, one and two, and you have the outputs of your first ranker, S1, and the output of your second ranker, S2, and you'd like to find the optimal combination of these two rankers. So I give you two black box rankers, give me a third ranker which works better than either of them. It turns out, because these guys are discrete, we're going to have to examine a finite number of these alphas. And in fact, it's the same cost as doing a ranknet update, a ranknet gradient. So it's not that expensive to do this. So we're using NDCG against itself. How does this work? Okay, on this picture, this is a real line tipped on its axis. And this corresponds to the outputs for one particular query, for one particular ranker. These are the outputs for the same query, same documents, but a different ranker. So as I move from one, if I do a convex combination of the output of the first ranker to the second, I move along a line joining these two points. So these are actually the same documents. They're just all different. Actually, that is, must be an old slide, doesn't look correct. Anyway, as I move along, I only have to look at places where these lines cross, because that's where the IOM metrics will change. And I can solve those in closed form. So what I do is I find all the places where pairs of lines cross. I find all the alphas for which that exists. That's a closed form solution. I order by alpha, which means I sweep from left to right here. And because I order by alpha, if there's no degeneracy, meaning no places where three lines cross, then it's true that whenever I encounter one of these points, two ranks of the two items that I'm examining must differ by one. It's a limit. So that means that I can keep track of the ranks as I sweep through from left to right, and everything works beautifully. I just said, actually, this slide. We compute alpha for all pairs. We sort by value, sweep through the values, keep track of these ranks as the line crosses. Then there's a lemma, the barring degeneracy, which you can get around by just jittering with a little bit of noise. Then ranks will always change by one, which means it's easy to keep track of the ranks, even if the guys don't. Even if they have the same level, you've got to keep track of the ranks. And then we can extend this whole trick to more than two rankers by iterating. So you take two rankers, find the optimal combination, treat them as a ranker, take a third, find the optimal combination, treat that as a ranker, take a fourth, and then iterate. So how might that be useful? Well, boosting is a very powerful method. It's an iterative procedure for finding functions, not just ranking, but classification, regression, whatever you like. This is a ranking function. It's basically a generalized linear model. It's a bunch of weights times a bunch of model outputs. And in fact, you can view these model outputs as a gradient in a function space, and I'll get back to that later, what I mean by that. And so boosting really has two steps. First, find this little, given that you've solved for some number of these guys, say n of them, and you want the n plus first, you first find the n plus first f, and then given that f, you find the optimal weight w. And we've just talked about a way to find w optimally for a given IR metric. So here's something that's nice, because so far IR metrics have been a pain in the neck, but now we can actually use them to solve the problem exactly. Okay. Now, I'm talking about something that's a little older. I think this crowd should enjoy this, if they know that sort of one already. where are we at? We want to learn this thing directly. So why not just use gradient descent? Well, because of this discontinuity or flood everywhere, but if you have enough data, and I'm measuring L is the loss function now, which is NDCG, or 1 minus NDCG in our case. If I have enough data, and I vary the parameters a little bit, that NDCG is going to change smoothly if I have enough data. Even though, on a given query, it's going to change dramatically. So that means that I can still get an empirical estimate of a gradient of this thing, provided I've got enough data. So this is one of the strange problem where it'll only work if you've got enough data. Enough means at least 10,000, probably closer to 100,000 queries, each with 50 docs. So it's going to be a lot of data. But let's just, let me tell you how this works. So this would be what you would do if you want to compute the gradient using the finite difference method. This is just a gradient. It's a more robust method than doing it just at one point. It's a symmetric gradient difference. And these are the parameters of your model. This is the cost function. C is some exploratory step size. And these are your essentially unit vectors in the various directions. So this is just the gradient. That requires 2D function evaluations. 2 times the number of, actually, I call this P later on, forgive me for that. So what is SPSA? It's a general method for performing gradient descent when the gradient is too slow or impossible to compute. How does it work? Okay, I have symmetric binary variables, so they take values plus or minus 1, with equal probability, and they're IID, these guys. And instead of what I just showed you, I'm going to instead compute this, which requires, instead of 2D evaluations of L, only 2 evaluations of L. And I'm going to use this for the gradient. This is totally insane. How could this possibly work? Well, here's one intuitive reason that it might work. If you look at the first guy here, you're dividing by the first component of this vector of random values. If you do an expansion of this, Taylor expansion, that component occurs in a dot product. And so that component cancels out. If you then do an expectation over the values of delta, the other guys will go to 0. You'll be left with the one gradient you care about. So it's not in the papers, it's just my own seat of the pants, sort of intuitive way to see why this might possibly work. here's a less seat of the pants theorem. This is why it possibly works. If your cost function's third derivative is a bounded, and the iteration number is this gradient descent iteration, and if the deltas are AID component-wise, and I'll say what this is in, actually on this slide, then the expectation of your estimate of the gradient minus the actual gradient given tangent goes down as ck squared. Remember, ck is this thing here where the subscript k is just put in for the iteration number. In fact, the details you might want to know if you step through the proof carefully. If I can bound these deltas by some number, which I can for Bernoulli guys, and if I can bound this inverse expectation by some other number, a positive number, this is again why Bernoulli is a good idea, and if the cost third derivatives are also bounded everywhere, then the bound looks like this. And it's interesting that where do these p's come from? The p, remember, is the dimension of the problem. It's the number of weights that you're solving for. And they essentially come from expectations of these products of deltas. And what Spall did in his proof was replace expectations of products of deltas with the max possible value. So this is a very loose bound. But if you'll notice, the only thing that depends on k is ck here. Everything else is gone away. I think you could make that much tighter just by looking at these expectations more carefully, I suspect. I don't know that. Here's a schematic view. This is from Spall's paper with his permission, actually. This would be gradient descent in red. Each time you're going perpendicular to the contours, this is the stochastic version, simultaneous perturbation stochastic approximation, gets you to the same spot in the same number of iterations, and that's the amazing thing. Let's try this. Okay, we're going to take cross entropy. Yes, yes.
What's the standard deviation of that?
I'm sorry?
The standard deviation of this estimate.
There's a second theorem that limits that also. So the standard deviation, the error you can actually bound. As the error goes to zero, the expectation of the error goes to zero as k goes to infinity also.
You can't come point down with k.
Yes, and any k.
One over t.
I don't know if it's one over t. Let me show you the thing afterwards. But there's a second theorem that I haven't stated here, lack of time, but it's equally important and it stresses exactly that problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the theorem of the limits are probably false stuff, but if you're going to be using
oh sure, this is old. This is very old stuff. This is 1992. This paper. I'm not claiming this is new at all. The only new thing is applying it to learning metrics that you normally can't use gradient descent, that are expensive to compute. The reason we want to do this is that MDCG you have to put all your data through, compute the SOAR, so it's sort of SOAR compute for a given set of your learning model. But with a trick like this, it becomes feasible. That's all. I'm not claiming this is new at all. This is algorithm. So what I've plotted here is SPSA with a cost function that is easy to compute, just as a sanity check. So this is the cross entropy, which we want to be small. And this is SPSA doing just, okay, what do I mean by 248? By 248, I mean compute this vector just once. Then I got two function evaluations for one gradient step. And I could do this whole thing twice with a new value of delta and take the average, and then I got four function evaluations, and that might give me a better convergence rate. I could do it again, and I've got eight, and so forth. Six, I mean, do it again, I've got eight. So doing this averaging might give you faster convergence. But what this graph shows is that as a function of the number of function evaluations, they're about the same. You don't gain much by doing this extra averaging to get a better approximation of the gradient. It's a horrible approximation of the gradient. I mean, every component, they only take two values.
Wait, is the x-axis the number of evaluations of L,
yes,
or the number of times that you take a step? In other words, is the green line four times as expensive as the blue line?
That's a good question.
It sort of doesn't matter, given that all the lines line up.
I mean, it's the number of evaluations of R, which is the slow. We can also do that as a graph, but that's what we care about as being a slow thing. That's the sort of gating factor of this company. Okay, so that's SPSA. What happens if you try just the first finite difference approximation? It's a lot slower. It's a lot slower. So SPSA is a big win. That was just a sanity check. So can we do this with a neural network? So we have NDCG. It's horrible and bumpy, and this is actually a picture of it being horrible and bumpy. I'll describe this in a minute. But let's try and do gradient descent anyway. I'm going to take a vast number of queries. I'm going to hope that NDCG is smooth because I've just averaged over enough queries. So what you have here is artificial data, a neural net, a linear neural net, and it's been trained. And I just want to see how smooth the neural net parameters are. I mean, the NDCG is a function of the neural net parameters. So what I've done here is I've got this neural net, it's got hundreds of parameters. It's linear, it's got 300 parameters. One of these curves corresponds to freezing all the weights, taking one, it's not frozen, varying it by this percentage. So that's a huge 50%, 100%, 150, huge variations in the weights. And with 100 queries, yes, it's very noisy. And I've done this for five weights here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I should really do it for all 300 of them. But it's interesting to look, see how noisy this is. Right? And let's do it for 100 queries, where it's a lot smoother. And again, I'm plotting NDCG versus how much I changed each weight. And for 1,000 queries, it's beginning to look, 10,000 queries, it's beginning to look a lot smoother. What's extraordinary about this is two things. I mean, it's not that extraordinary, but what's interesting is that it's smooth. But the other thing is, I'm showing you here the output of a neural net trained using lambda run. But it's going to be tough to beat this because it's at a local maximum. So that means that every time I do this, draw this graph, it actually seems to have found a local maximum, not in the thing that we, the cost that we, sort of ANSAS cost we use to train this thing, but actually what we care about, the NDCG. And this is why we did use SPSA to try and directly train neural nets. It did not beat lambda rank, it didn't come close. Lambda rank is actually finding an optimum, a local optimum at least.
Is this with a linear net?
This is the linear net, and in fact, well, I'll get to this to them in a second. So the only thing that could go wrong, there's a few things. One thing is that maybe the other weights are actually much worse behaved than the local weights. We just plot in a few of them. What else could go wrong? Yes, this could be a local optimum, right? But I can easily detect local optima by just retraining the random initial weights, and that also was the same. Very, very similar numbers. So it looks like lambda rank is empirically optimal. That's a new result. What about two layers? Here's artificial data. It's not quite as clean. 10,000 queries. We again freeze all the weights for every one, and again it looks sort of roughly optimal. On real data, you have some weights that are very flat, and others that are less so. But again, it looks fairly optimal. These are just the output. The ten hidden unit net. These are the 10 output weights I'm varying. Okay. However, if you zoom in on this graph, you get this graph. So. If you're going to use this trick, the take-home messages, you better be very careful to make sure that your step sizes or your average, you do some kind of averaging over the amount of noise that's present. There's still a lot of noise present if you look at a high enough level of magnification of these curves. And you better not do gradient descent here unless you use large enough step sizes. So that's the key take-home message. All right, I'm running out of time. Let me just quickly throw a spanner in the works, so to speak, by telling you of an idea that we also tried. So far the whole philosophy of this talk has been optimized directly the NDCG, it'll give you better results, you know. So now we're going to do the opposite. Let's just use classification. Let's challenge our assumptions. We've got really powerful classifiers, neural nets, subordinate machines, boosted trees. We're going to use boosted trees. Let's just see how well we do with classification on this problem. Why? Because perfect classification. So now I'm going to take my five levels of relevance. I'm just going to classify into each level of relevance and then order by those classifications. Well, obviously, if I do that and I get to do a perfect job, then I get max DCG because everything's ordered correctly. So here are the three basic models we'll look at. Multi-class classification, ordinal classification, the statisticians just call this ordinal classification. It's just the probability that the class is less than or equal to the target class. And regression, using the kinds of model targets that NDCG would be appropriate for. It's very simple to show, and it's intuitively obvious, but this is the max DCG a given query can get. That's the DCG you get for a particular permutation pi of your URLs. It's bounded above by the classification error. So n is the number of documents. This is actually the actual classification error, square root of it. And these CIs are the 1/log things I showed you before. These are the discount parameters. And this doesn't depend on the order. This is just a fixed number for a given n. So, a bit more justification. Well, how do we get from a five-class classifier to a ranker? We have to output a single score, so we'll just take the expectation of the relevance as the score. We could use any monotonic function of k. And we'll do standard boosted trees using cross-entropy loss, which is this. And this is a one-slide summary of gradient boosting of Friedman and Company, and also Mason. Essentially, it's a stepwise procedure where at a given, this is your approximation at a given, at the n minus first step for your feature vector x. These are the labels, this is the loss function. You want to learn a new tree or something, and a new step size beta to minimize the loss when you add that to your previous set of functions. That's what you'd like to do, but this is a bit too hard to do because this loss is hard to compute. Which tree would give you the biggest gain in loss, decrease in loss? So instead what they do is very clever. They compute the gradient of the cost at each point, which we compute in closed form, and model that instead. Now this is just the least squares thing. Now, these are just a bunch of numbers. So I can easily do this. And then, given the tree you get by doing this, this is a standard regression tree, even though we're doing classification, you can do a line search to find the optimal step size along that direction, and then do your update, and you've got your new estimate of your function. So that's gradient boosting in one slide. So how we use it is we have k trees per boosting iteration, one for each class. As I said, each tree fits the gradient. The line search is performed for each leaf using a Newton-Raphson step. And then you do the same kind of tricks as neural nets, output to probabilities using the heuristic. Okay. It beats lambda rank. So the red here is the lambda rank results in the test set. Two-layer, 16,000 training queries and 10,000 tests. This is the regression results from ART, and this is the classification as a function of the number of iterations. Remember, each iteration is generating five trees. It's a bit of a mystery, right? Here are the same results but shown differently. Again, plotted versus truncation level, four different methods. Lambda rank is the bottom. It gets better and better as you go up in terms of these flavors of MART. So I'm out of time, so I think I'm going to skip the next few slides, which were how to build weak learners that directly solve the ranking problem. Come to me afterwards if you'd like to find out more about XRank. Let me skip to the sorry, there's a lot of slides. There we go. Okay, so there's a lot of interesting things that you have to solve when you try to learn to rank with information retrieval metrics. And by the way, you might ask, why NDCG? You know, what's magic about NDCG? We have measured strong correlations with NDCG and other things we care about, like rates of abandonment of the users of the web pages, the click-through rates. So there does seem to be a good metric to use to model user satisfaction in one easy to compute number. But it's a tough thing to optimize directly. I think eventually all these methods will converge to having similar performance, and the trick will be choosing the right features and the clean labels. But here's something that people often don't spend much time thinking about. The reason we use neural nets in the first place was they're extremely fast in test space. SVMs with kernels, far too slow, wouldn't even consider it. Boosted trees, maybe. Actually, maybe not. But we are looking at boosted trees next. All right, thanks very much.